This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 86 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me, as always, is Zachary Frühling. Today, we're going to be discussing the nature of good versus evil inside the Star Trek universe. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm feeling particularly evil.
I'm sitting here in this darkened lair of malevolence.
Darkened layer of malevolence.
So one of us has to be good and one of us has to be evil. We're both pretty good guys.
At heart.
We've actually had this topic suggested to us more than a couple of times from some of our listeners, and we decided, let's dive in and take it on. And I have to say that Star Trek is full of these good versus evil. All great storytelling really revolves around the idea often of good versus evil, and we see that quite often inside the Star Trek universe. There's always kind of a bad guy of the week kind of scenario in many of these episodes. And so this isn't uncommon in the Star Trek universe. This isn't uncommon in storytelling as a whole. Books that we've read since we were children take on this whole idea of, you know, good wins, evil loses, and that's just good storytelling. And so it seems like that this would be a no-brainer, but as we were talking in the turbo lift, this might be an interesting conversation.
I think part of the reason we waited so long to do this topic was that we don't really know what to say about it. I think generally we have a better understanding of good than we do of evil, right? We understand goodness. We know that, you know, helping old ladies cross the street is good. Helping the sick and the infirm is good. There's lots of examples of goodness we can draw upon. I think we understand evil far less than we understand goodness. You mentioned bad guys in Star Trek. There are certainly bad characters that do bad things, but there's a substantive difference between bad in the ordinary sense and evil in a deeper, more substantive sense. So I think in order to really have this discussion about good versus evil, we need to spend a little time trying to figure out what exactly evil is and then what exactly evil means inside the Star Trek universe. People that do bad things aren't necessarily evil. Like, I don't think here in the real world, I don't think someone jaywalking is evil, for example, although it might be bad to break the rules. I don't think Tom Paris stealing replicator rations on Voyager is evil just because he's doing something bad. So what are the defining characteristics of evil as distinct from something bad? And then are there actually examples of pure evil in Star Trek, not just bad guys?
Yeah, because the interesting thing about bad guys, is, and especially in the Star Trek universe, you know, when we were first introduced to Star Trek in the 1960s, Klingons were the bad guys. They were evil. They were foul. They were anti-human and
they twirled their mustaches.
They twirled their mustaches. Yes, Mudd was evil in a really fun sort of way. But So in the original series, that was our introduction to evil, and I draw upon the Klingons because they were kind of the recurring bad guy. I think Romulans, you could make certainly a case for the Romulans, but let's say the Klingons.
Are you saying that mustache twirling is necessary but not sufficient for evil?
Mustache twirling, and it never hurts to have a dark hat. That's always a good thing to have, a hat of some sort. But the interesting thing about that is that when we got Star Trek The Next Generation, and let's even draw upon the movies to some degree, the original series movies, Undiscovered Country, we find the Klingons in crisis, and they almost become sympathetic. In fact, I'll go so far as to say, I think that they were largely sympathetic. So by the time that we get to The Next Generation, the Klingons are no longer the bad guy. They're no longer evil. They're our ally, and not just an ally, but actually a good ally.
In Star Trek The Next Generation, the Klingons and the Romulans did a kind of role reversal from the original series.
Yes.
So I think the Romulans in The Next Generation are a better candidate for that mustache-twirling evil character than the Klingons.
Once you get to unification in The Next Generation, we're introduced to an entire subculture of Romulans that are good guys. And they're not just good guys. They're good guys that you cheer for. And why do you cheer for them? Because Spock is their champion, you know? So I think an argument can be made that even in Next Generation, I think it's unfair to just label Romulans bad guys. And isn't that the nature of the world that we live in? It's easy to say, you know, these people are good and those people are bad. And we look around at the world that we live in and, you know, perhaps maybe we can point at certain countries and say they're bad, or certain leaders and we say they're bad, or certain groups of people and we say they're bad. But really, once you get to understand, and I'm a believer in first seek to understand and then to be understood. And so once you get to the point of trying to understand, you discover oftentimes that these countries or leaders or peoples or subgroups or whatever aren't necessarily bad. They're oftentimes understood. They stand for things. And while they stand against the ideas or principles that maybe we as individuals hold, certainly in terms of countries, you know, when you're talking about ideals and principles and you look at countries or people or groups that are anti those ideas and principles, it's easy to label that bad, but I think that's very unfair because it comes down to this kind of deeper question. You know, it's one thing to disagree and to be anti something, but is that really evil? And I think that's really at the heart of what we're going to try to dig into as we peel away the layers of Star Trek in search of, you know, what is truly good and what is truly evil.
You touched on something a moment ago that I think is accurate about Star Trek. Star Trek has a history of humanizing its bad guys and making them sympathetic. I don't think Star Trek does much in the way of creating a purely evil character that is not redeemable per se.
The only exception that I find to that is within Deep Space Nine. I think they really give us our first glimpse of evil in the Star Trek universe. Now, I say that with one caveat. There is a character in TNG I think that might be a good candidate for being truly evil, a truly malevolent character inside of Star Trek The Next Generation. But to really explore the idea of evil, we're given oftentimes these unnamed characters we call Paw Wraiths. And Star Trek Deep Space Nine really explores them heavily, especially in latter seasons of Deep Space Nine. In fact, at one point in time, we're introduced to a particular Paw Wraith named Costimogen. And Kai Winn described Costimogen as the evil one, a particular Paw Wraith who was banished from the Celestial Temple. And of course, inside the episode The Reckoning, that Paw Wraith possessed the body of Jake Sisko. And I'm sure we'll get into that and we'll talk about that in depth later on the podcast. But I think in that we have what could possibly be a real candidate for evil inside the Star Trek universe.
It's interesting to me that you bring up the Paw Wraiths and Costimogen, because in Christian theology, for example, there's a genuine disagreement about whether the concept of evil requires a substantive, proactive evil force, or whether evil is just a lack of goodness or a privation of goodness. So, for example, the Christian theologian and philosopher St. Augustine, way back in the 5th century AD, held that evil was a lack of goodness, that there was no separate force or separate substance called evil. Evil was literally just a lack of goodness. And you can contrast that view of evil with the view of evil as requiring a substantive force. And, you know, Christian theology also has that concept in the devil or demons or whatnot. And the Paw Wraiths are more similar to that proactive sense of evil. They're this separate, non-corporeal, active force for evil in the Star Trek universe, much like Satan or the devil or demons in Christian theology. But that itself is controversial in Christian theology, whether the concept of evil needs that kind of concept, or whether you can give an adequate account of evil and evil actions minus that sort of proactive, conscious evil force.
A lot of philosophers, Zachary, and correct me if I'm wrong, especially the more modern, I'd say the 20th century philosophers especially, have often argued that this is really kind of a false dichotomy to differentiate between good and evil. Am I right or am I wrong about that? Is it a false dichotomy?
Well, I think the 20th century gave us some interesting examples, right? The 20th century gave us the Hitlers of the universe, right? And so there are go-to examples. We go, oh, you need an example of an evil person? Let's point to Hitler, right? You can do that after the 20th century in a way that you couldn't necessarily do that before the 20th century. I'm not sure who you would point to in before the 20th century. Nero, maybe, in the ancient Roman Empire, you'd point to as evil in some sense. I think it varies by philosopher, right? Some philosophers don't think there is anything called evil. Some philosophers try to humanize those that you would claim to be evil. It really is all over the map. I don't think you can give a general characteristic of it like that. But I think it's still valuable to take the time to ask, what would the defining characteristics of evil be? To distinguish it from things like jaywalking or stealing replicator rations. You know, is it particularly harmful to other individuals? Is it particularly callous? Is it particularly large in scale? Is it more like genocide and less like your ordinary run-of-the-mill murder? Right? What are those defining characteristics that are necessary to distinguish something as being evil? I don't think that's clear at all. I think it's partly a matter of scale. Evil people tend to do the really, really, really bad things on a grand scale. You know, the obvious clear examples of evil, I'm sort of pointing back to the 20th century, thinking of the Hitlers, right? Evil people tend to have a particularly calloused attitude towards the suffering of others. They turn a blind eye, or they don't mm-hmm. care, or maybe they even enjoy it, right? So it has something to do with their intentions as well. But the same is true of many other ordinary bad actions as well. So, you know, how great of an action does it have to be before an action becomes evil? And how bad do a person's intentions have to be before that person who has those intentions becomes evil? Is it a line drawing problem? It's just the same kind of quality, just badness writ large to a large degree? Or does it have some substantively different character with different qualities, different traits than ordinary bad actions?
You mentioned particularly someone evil really enjoying or delighting in the suffering of others. And so
pulling the wings off flies, you know, I don't know. So pulling the wings off Talaxian fur flies.
Yeah. So I think it's an important distinction, because it is possible to do something wrong in order to accomplish something good in the end. And I think we see examples of that inside the Star Trek universe. And we've talked many, many times about, you know, for instance, some of the controversial decisions and choices that Sisko made in Deep Space Nine that really produced positive results in terms of turning the tide of war. We see in Voyager, you know, Tom Paris, since you're mentioning Tom Paris and replicator rations, you know, Tom Paris disobeyed Captain's orders and interfered in the development of a culture, which resulted in his losing a pip on his collar. anyone who watches 30 Days will walk away from that going, you know, that Tom Paris, he did a good thing. it was totally worth, you know, he's sitting there writing a letter to his father and he never said it in the episode, but you know, he was thinking it, man, that was totally worth that pip.
I guess my point is that it's hard to give a substantive account of evil other than distinguishing it from a bunch of other things that evil is not. It's almost a negative type of definition. Like, evil is not stealing replicator rations. Evil is not having a weakness of will. Evil is not making a mistake. Evil is not a lack of judgment, right? While that way of talking is not a substantively positive account of evil, it helps kind of narrow the field and distinguish genuine evil from things that are evil-like, that we still don't like, we still don't think are morally praiseworthy, but not evil per se. But that's not quite the same thing as giving a positive account of evil in terms of what traits and qualities that, you know, evil really does have as opposed to these other things.
Yeah, so what you're saying is it's possible to do something that is deemed negative or even wrong and still not be evil.
That's absolutely right. I think we have lots of other concepts that are negative that aren't evil.
Yeah, I agree completely. And that's why it's difficult to pin on virtually any species inside the Star Trek universe, even though, again, we go back to the original series, it was the Klingons, it was the Romulans, and then once we got to Next Generation, it was predominantly the Romulans, and then, you know, later on we were introduced to the Cardassians, and, you know, they were pretty untrustworthy. Once we get to Deep Space Nine, we find out that, you know, they're kind of bad guys to a great degree. But once we get to the end of Deep Space Nine, you know, we're rooting for them because they're being slaughtered by the new bad guy, the Dominion. And so we keep one-upping the bad guys in Star Trek. And yet, at some point in time, we discover that these bad guys are by and large mostly redeemable.
It's interesting you say that there's some bad guy one-upmanship, because this is something I've held about Star Trek Voyager for a long time, that every time Star Trek Voyager introduces a bad guy, a bad race, a bad species, an adversary, they have to kind of one-up that. So it's not enough just to have the Borg. It's not enough to have a quadrant full of Borg. They have to introduce species 8472, and they're really, really evil when they introverse.
Better than the Borg.
Yeah, they're really, really evil when they introduce species 8472 for about a week until they humanize them and realize, oh, they're just misunderstood and they're afraid too and they're being defensive too. So they're not evil. They're just poor misunderstood species 8472. This is something Star Trek does again and again and again. Anytime they introduce a potential evil individual or a potential evil race or an evil adversary, either they one-up it and they try to introduce another adversary to make the first one seem not so bad, or they make that adversary sympathetic and understandable and hence defang, declaw that adversary and make it seem less evil.
Sure. And enter once again the two candidates that I have for truly evil entities inside of Star Trek, and that is Armus from Skin of Evil. Of course, the ink and caro syrup character of Vegra 2 inside that first season episode. Of course, Armus is infamous for having killed Tasha Yar. And it's interesting that they called that episode Skin of Evil. I think the episode title is revealing in some sense, but the interesting thing about that entity is that it truly seemed unredeemable. I mean, my gosh, even Sweet Data thought that Armus should be destroyed.
Well, speaking of the title, what do you think of the title Skin of Evil? When I hear Skin of Evil, not having the episode in mind, just the title on its own, it connotes to me that whatever has this skin of evil is not evil through and through, that evil is kind of an outer
cloak. It's a facade.
It's a facade in a way. And that's a very Star Trek way of thinking about evil, that evil is a kind of facade, a mask, something that's misunderstood, something you could get beyond or work your way through, whatever. And that evil is not so pervasive that a potentially evil character is not redeemable or changeable or improvable. But Armus is not terribly redeemable in that episode. Certainly doesn't end up that way.
Armus is not redeemable at all. Again, Data strongly felt that Armus should be destroyed. And that's coming from an analytical mind disconnected from any type of emotion, simply looking at, you know, the facts and realities and saying, you know, this creature is unredeemable and should be destroyed. It's interesting because Troy, in all of her empathic prowess, she kind of gets underneath that facade. She
kind of
gets
underneath
the skin of evil. And she discovers an origin to that evil, and that is a sense of abandonment, an anger that that originated at this sense of abandonment that this creature felt. And Captain Picard, even to some degree, alludes to the idea that this is merely an entity that has become enslaved to serve evil purposes. See, it's interesting because Picard was speaking to Armus and he quoted Prometheus Unbound. He said, "All spirits are enslaved that serve things evil." I think that's really an interesting take on Armus's condition in life.
So two things came to my mind there, Mike. One is the question of whether we've hit on something as an identifying characteristic of evil. Is someone or something in Star Trek that is evil have to be irredeemable? If a being, a person, an adversary, a race, or whatever is evil, does that mean that they're irredeemable? Is that a necessary characteristic of evil? So that's one question. The other question I have is about Armus. Does the fact that Counselor Troy, and to some extent Captain Picard, psychologically deconstruct Armus's evilness and the motivations for his actions, you know, the sense of abandonment, does that itself undermine the sense that he's evil and irredeemable?
I don't think there are any easy answers to that question, because even at the end of that episode, you know, they're able to get away and they basically trick Armus into letting them go, and they leave Armus behind to live another evil day. And so
he throws a Darth Vader tantrum. No.
And if this were a general geekdom podcast, I think we can point back to a Darth Vader or you know, the Sith and the Force inside of Star Wars. But this is a Star Trek podcast.
But there's some similarity there.
There are some similarities.
The similarity is that there are no hard and fast, purely evil or purely good people inside Star Wars, right? The characters in Star Wars that are drawn towards the dark side versus drawn towards the good side of the Force, they are not irredeemable, right? We see Darth Vader get redeemed. We see character after character kind of get redeemed. And there are characters that don't get redeemed, but presumably in Star Wars, they're redeemable in principle, I guess. And I think that's very similar to how Star Trek thinks of evil, right? There are some exceptions. There are characters that don't actually get redeemed. They get killed or whatever, but they're not viewed as irredeemable, I think.
Well, that's the overwhelming theme of episodes 4 through 6 of Star Wars, the original trilogy. It's all about the redemption of Anakin Skywalker. But Armus is a little bit different, because if I understand, it's been a little while since I've seen this episode, but Zachary, as I understand it, Armus really was all of the malevolence of a creature separated out and given its own existence.
And dipped in chewing tobacco.
And or at least Karo syrup and ink. Yeah, so this really isn't in and of itself an entity, but rather all of the malevolence of an entity separated out and discarded on Vegra 2.
Yeah, this is strange, because this really does kind of veer into fantasy territory, right? This is very abstract, right? We're talking about the abstract qualities of malevolence of whomever dumped these malevolent qualities on this planet that have been aggregated and fused together into this being. This sounds more like fantasy than science fiction. You know, I always kind of thought of Armus as being something like a creature, you know. I don't know to what extent it's biological versus something else, but it, you know, what you described sounds more like a fantasy concept, you know, the personification of malevolent qualities.
Yeah, and that's what I find fascinating about this episode is that we're not dealing with just an entity that was discarded by its race or anything like that, but rather we're dealing with a creature who was almost created to some degree. It literally is the skin of evil of another creature discarded there. So in and of itself, I think to some degree it is unredeemable because it is all of the malevolence and anything that was good walked away from it.
He's like Satan in the book of Job walking to and fro across the earth.
Picking up
malevolent qualities as he goes.
Or at least sloshing to and fro.
It's like, Armus, pick up your slime trail of malevolence, will you? Clean up after yourself, buddy.
But yeah, so you know, they happen across what is basically the evil discharge of another creature. And if that is truly the case, if that's what Armus is, then I think Armus becomes a good candidate for something being truly evil inside the Star Trek universe and therefore unredeemable.
Well, I think you're onto something there, because there is this idea in Christian theology that evil doesn't just go away, it just moves around, right? That, you know, the concept of a little devil sitting on your shoulder, right? That devil doesn't just go away, it just moves on and goes and bothers someone else, right? It's not something that is eliminated, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. It just goes from person to person looking for opportunity to opportunity. It's not something that is eliminatable.
So I'm thinking about this, Zachary, and as I recall in the episode, Armus says, "I don't serve things evil," when Picard said that. He responded by saying, "I am evil." So he really is a malevolent entity that is created. We don't know anything about the race. We just know that it's a race of Titans, and they brought this thing out from within themselves. It's all of the evil and negativity and all of these foul attributes and bound them together and poured some curious syrup on it and some printer's ink, and there you have it. Here's Armus. So, yeah, I think it really is a picture of evil inside the Star Trek universe.
Again, philosophically, I'm interested in trying to give a defining account of evil, and I think maybe you hit on something else. Evil is seductive in a way, right? Evil, we have this language on purpose. We tend to personify evil because oftentimes what happens is that you have people who are fundamentally good people that end up doing very bad things. And it's almost like there's a voice, a seductive force, you know, the sirens off in the distance if you're on a ship, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, there's this proactive calling force, a recruitment, a seduction, a salesmanship process. But evil is proactive in that way, seen on that account. And there's no great way to talk about that except to personify it. And that's why you get so much personification of evil in literature and fiction and whatnot, because that's the best account we can give of this seductive feeling of evil that we perceive in good people doing bad things.
Even in Judean and certainly Christian theology, we go back to the book of Genesis and we discover that the first appearance of evil was that of the most subtle, the Bible calls it the most subtle beasts of the field. It was the serpent, and certainly not as we think of serpents today in terms of snakes, but rather something that was beautiful, it was subtle, it was seductive, and it tricks to some degree Eve into picking that forbidden fruit and eating it, and then she gave it to her husband to eat, and that is what we know as original sin. And it was simply a generation later, and we have the first murder between their two sons, Cain and Abel. Cain slays his brother Abel because of jealousy and pride. And so we see how, at least in Christian theology, how evil has entered the world. But there's actually a backstory to that, and that is the story of an angel by the name of Lucifer, who was an archangel. And because of his own pride and his own arrogance, he was able to deceive and convince a third part of God's angels to rise up, and there was war in heaven, and Satan, as he became known as, was cast out of heaven along with the third part of the angels. And so that theology sounds a lot more like what we see in Deep Space Nine with Cosmogen and the Paw Wraith.
Yeah, it's very similar.
It sounds very similar. Mm-hmm. But we see, and you referenced the book of Job earlier, you know, we see, at least in Christian theology, this idea of evil being loose in the world, going to and fro, and not necessarily controlling, but rather deceiving, preying upon negative feelings, negative emotions, negative ideas, and out of that, you know, pulling forth evil acts. We can look around and we can point, you mentioned Hitler and the Holocaust. I think anyone can look at that and say, that was truly an evil act. You know, you're trying to commit the genocide of an entire people group, and you know, we can say that's evil. We can look at the Twin Towers of 9/11, and we can say that was an evil act. But in Christian theology, that evil act has an origin, and that origin is Lucifer. Much the same way that the Paw Wraiths, in particular Cosmogen, was able to commit evil through, you know, Jake in The Reckoning became possessed by Cosmogen. Later on, Gul Dukat becomes possessed by a Paw Wraith and acts on its behalf. Kai Winn certainly was manipulated by her own ambitions and became an agent of evil. And I had to get Kai Winn in there because I know about half of our listeners are out there going, Kai Winn, Kai Winn, Kai Winn, she's truly evil. And I can say that I despise Kai Winn as much as any of you out there listening, but I don't think Kai Winn is a good candidate for someone being truly evil. Sorry.
Well, you hit on something with this notion of evil walking to and fro, looking for opportunities, deceiving, seducing, whatever. I think this is the subtle genius of Armus saying to Captain Picard that he's not serving something evil. In other words, he hasn't been seduced by evil. He hasn't been deceived by evil. He is the one walking to and fro being evil, right? I think there's a subtle distinction there. It's not just that he's a good being that's been turned by evil or is doing bad things. He's literally supposed to be the evil one.
But the difference, Zachary, for Armus at least, is that fortunately, I was going to say unfortunately, but actually it's very fortunate that he seems to be constrained inside that planet of Vegra 2. He's stuck there. There's no wandering to and fro. He's only looking for opportunity, and a shuttlecraft comes by and he's able to get it, and he's got toys in the form of Troy and Tasha and Data, and they become toys for him to act out his evil fantasies.
Wouldn't it be great to have a stasis chamber for evil?
I would be all for that.
Put it in a box.
Well, you know. Well, and we find that in mythology, don't we?
Pandora's box is a...
Yeah, Pandora's box. All of the evil of the world in mythology was put inside that box. And then once it was opened, it escaped out into the world. So that becomes an origin story for evil inside of Greek and Roman mythology. And the empty box, what was left, represented hope.
So rather than Pandora's box, we need to put Armus in Pandora's stasis chamber.
we can put Armus in there and Costimogen and Kai Winn and Gul Dukat. And
it's kind of like the Ghostbusters. Can't you picture the Enterprise, you know, warping around the galaxy, using its Bessard collectors to sort of suck up the evil and put it in the Pandora's stasis chamber?
Maybe that's what Armus is. Maybe the ectoplasm isn't green, Zachary. It's black. maybe that's what Armus is. Just the kind of entrail leftovers of evil. But I like this idea of a stasis chair. Right. I really do. I mean, if we can put Moriarty in a basically a thumb drive, I mean, why not?
Well, that's essentially what they did. They put him in Pandora's stasis chamber. Exactly. Pandora's holodeck.
Just basically an oversized thumb drive.
Again, I feel like we're kind of just whittling down on these aspects of evil that, you know, we're struggling to give a substantive account of evil, but we're hitting on little nuances that can be incorporated into an account of evil. If evil can't be eliminated per se, if that's a substantive part of evil, if you can't just kill the Paw Wraiths, if you can't just turn off Moriarty, if you can't just, phaser Armus, you know, whatever it is, then what do? You try to contain the evil if you can't just eliminate it.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And again, you know, inside of Deep Space Nine, I think that is largely the purpose of their religion. And that's certainly a role that religion plays in the lives of the Bajorans, to help them focus their attention on the Celestial Temple and the prophets and the way of the prophets. And, you know, they follow the prophets. Why? Because there is also a seductive evil out there. There are Paw Wraiths, and if they're not careful, they can become seduced and go, down a negative path. Does that make them evil? Well, no, more than any behavior. I mean, you know, you've mentioned we were whittling down here. So we know that if we define evil as a behavior, we can't really do that because it's a behavior. It's not truly evil. It may be a negative behavior, but is that behavior inherently evil?
And the same behavior can be done from any number of different motivations.
Sure. And so I think the answer to that is no. I don't think that we can pin evil to any particular entity in terms of, you know, country or leader or people, or in the Star Trek universe, it's, you know, evil is not the Romulan Star Empire. It's not the Klingon Empire. It's not even the Borg Collective. Now, these may all at some time or another do evil things, but they are not in and of themselves evil.
The Borg is an interesting potential candidate for an evil species, an evil race inside Star Trek, because they are not redeemable per se. That kind of nameless, faceless automaton aspect of the Borg, the fact that they just keep coming and coming and coming. They're like zombies, essentially, yeah. Right? The Borg, you know, being in a Borg cube is like being in a zombie movie. And there's no redeemable quality to a zombie, right? They just keep coming and coming and coming, and you're not going to convince them otherwise.
I actually thought about that, Zachary, as I was trying to get some ideas for candidates within the Star Trek universe for evil, and the Borg actually come to mind. But once I thought about it, I couldn't escape the examples within the Star Trek universe of Borg who were freed from the collective. I think of Hugh in Star Trek The Next Generation. I think of Seven of Nine. I think of Icheb. These are all Borg who were freed from the collective. So I really can't unilaterally say the Borg are unredeemable.
Well, Hugh and Seven of Nine and Icheb are more like the beings that are being seduced by evil rather than the evil ones walking to and fro. The Borg Queen is a little more like Satan in the Book of Job walking around to and fro, trying to assimilate as many people as possible, right? Fundamentally, the Borg are off the hook because they're all being controlled by the Borg Queen.
Now, there we have, I think, peeled away some layers to make a discovery here, or a distinction, perhaps. I think the Borg Queen might be a candidate for evil.
Well, let's go down the list. Is the Borg Queen redeemable?
I don't believe she is.
We don't have any evidence that she is, right? And she keeps popping up, even after
because,
she dies.
Because she seems to be the only Borg who really has autonomy.
If you think the Borg Queen is redeemable, you are thinking way too three-dimensionally. Certainly the Borg Queen acts on a grand scale. She's closer to Hitler, right? She acts on a genocide scale. They assimilate entire worlds, right?
Right.
So you've got the concept of evil being a matter of degree, right? The really bad actions that affect a great many people, a great many whatever.
And I'm not defending the Borg Queen, but one could possibly argue that her motivation is noble to some degree, because she claims at least that her quest is to find perfection. And is that not a noble quest? Or is that just one of those subtle deceptions?
You know, I keep coming back to Christian theology because it's what I grew up on and it's what I know. It's the language I have to talk about these concepts.
I'm there too, and I'm trying to look at this circumspectly. It's difficult.
Well, here's what came to mind, right? So Satan or Lucifer, in rebelling against God, wanted to be more godlike, right? Mm-hmm. It was a hubris to that. And the Borg Queen, attempting to attain perfection, there's a kind of self-important hubris to that, thinking that you're able to achieve this abstract, unattainable concept of perfection and go and doing horrendous things in the name of this thing that sounds really great. It sounds very similar to this idea of trying to be God.
Well, that was the original deception when the serpent possessed by Lucifer, Satan, spoke to Eve. The basic general argument that the serpent made was that God is holding out. God is holding out on you. He knows if you eat that fruit that you will become like gods, knowing good and evil. And so that was the original deception. God is holding out. And certainly that was Satan's attitude. That was Lucifer's attitude, believing that, why not? Why should we all serve him? Why shouldn't we all be like him? And that was the original deception. And so I see that quality in the Borg Queen, in her quest for perfection. It's almost an arrogance, almost a sense of pride that drives.
I can picture the Borg Queen whispering in Seven of Nine's ear with their mystical, Borg speak across distances. Seven of Nine, rejoin the collective and attain perfection.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally what she did.
Right. It's very much like Satan whispering, eat of this tree and you'll be godlike.
Yeah, and even once liberated, I mean, Seven of Nine didn't just shed that idea that the quest for perfection was possible. And that was something that we saw inside the episode, The Omega Directive. I mean, she was still very much pulled back into that quest, that idea that perfection was something that could be attained.
Again, I think we're spiraling in towards this concept of evil. I think there is this sense that evil is recurring, right? It doesn't just go away. It's always there in the background. You can ignore it. You can change, you can try to be a better person, but it's always there kind of lurking in the background saying, oh, if you just follow me, if you just do this, if you just do that, then you can have this great thing, have something you always wanted. You can have perfection. You can be godlike. You can be whatever. And it's not, there's a reason that it's described as a voice on the shoulder whispering in your ear, right? Because that kind of quality, this inner voice that we speak to ourselves, I think is an important part of that. That's not something you get rid of. I think that's something that you ignore, learn to think better about, but I don't think it goes away.
Yeah. I think we can agree. And it seems to me, Zachary, that we're making a pretty good case for the Borg Queen possibly being unredeemable, perhaps a candidate for true evil.
More so than Armus.
More, you think more so than Armus?
I don't know. That's my question.
At this point, I'm thinking Armus of Vegra II and the Borg Queen, that might be a match made in hell. I'm not sure. I mean, they're both pretty unredeemable. I think they're both excellent candidates for evil. And I think anyone listening to the podcast can say, okay, there is a tremendous gulf between these two characters, Armus of Vegra II and the Borg Queen. There is a huge gulf between those two characters and, say, Tomalak or Kai Winn or Gul Dukat. I think that there's a vast chasm between these two characters and just the general bad guy inside of Star Trek.
But what exactly is the difference between the Borg Queen and Armus and these other individuals that we just mentioned? Certainly, the Borg Queen can act on a grander scale, right? They've got more Borg ships, and they, mm-hmm. you know, they basically control an entire quadrant and more inside Voyager. The Borg Queen thinks she's acting for good. She thinks she is attaining perfection. Or does she?
Does so without conscience.
Or is that a facade? Is that lip service to this concept of perfection? And really, the Borg Queen knows full well that she doesn't have any actual interest in perfection. Her goal is power and conquest and controlling others. And in other words, how malevolent is the Borg Queen? Does she think she's doing something good in the name of perfection, or is that lip service and she thinks she's acting for something that's genuinely evil? I guess my point is that if it's the former, if she thinks she's acting for something good, then she's a little more like Gul Dukat and a little more like even Khan or any of the characters in Star Trek that do bad things but do it in the name of something they think is good.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Khan, and we're going to come back to Khan here in a minute, but I think that's a difficult question. Your question, I think, is very difficult to answer, except to make some observations. That it seems to me that her quest is very self-serving. You know, perfection for whom? It seems to me that she's the only autonomous one amongst the Borg. And so it occurs to me that perhaps her quest is very self-serving. And she's willing to literally commit genocide, to assimilate entire worlds, to add to her own conception of perfection, to add to her own, and really, what is perfection for her? It is a quest for power. Even the Omega molecule. What was so unique about the Omega molecule? It was raw power. It was almost uncontainable power. And so the Borg go out and they assimilate worlds to amass power. They call it adding to their perfection, but it occurs to me that it really is all about amassing power. And almost that seems to me more evil than, say, an Armus who, you know, he's more like a Venus flytrap. I mean, he's like... I mean, some unsuspecting shuttlecraft just gets stuck and you know, he's got something to chew on for a couple of days. I mean, he's he's like an alien Venus flytrap.
Feed me, Seymour, feed me.
So Zachary, I think you may be convincing me that the Borg Queen, more so than even Armus, is probably a better candidate for evil.
Well, Armus is tragic, right? He feels abandoned. You sort of go, oh, poor Armus. He's just throwing a temper tantrum.
I mean, certainly Troy makes me feel bad for him.
Right. And I don't think you can give that same kind of, oh, poor Borg Queen story that you can give about Armus. No, this is a serious challenge about the Borg Queen for listeners out there and for you, Mike. Can you give a psychological account of the Borg Queen that makes her more sympathetic and makes you go, aw, poor Borg Queen, in a way that you can with Armus?
Not without retconning canon. I mean, I think with what we have in terms of canon for the Borg Queen, I see nothing redeemable about her actions.
Well, the Borg Queen is just too aware of what she's doing, right? Everything she's doing is very intentional and very conscious, and I don't think anyone really buys her lip service to the concept of perfection.
No, I don't either. Now, Data did for 0.68 seconds, I think it was.
Yes, 0.68 seconds, right? Is that right?
Which is an eternity for an android.
And I guess, and with the Borg Queen, it's not like this is a one-time thing, because we all do that. We all convince ourselves that doing something wrong is the right thing to do. We've all done that in one way or another. I think that's a normal part of human experience, right? For anyone. But the Borg Queen, it's systematic and pervasive, and at such a grand scale, and she's so aware of what she's doing, and it's such a facade, this concept of perfection, that you just see right through it. You can't plausibly say that that is being done out of some higher noble purpose.
And so I think Armus of Vegra 2 falls to the Borg Queen, but does the Borg Queen stack up against the Paw Wraiths, Costa Mojin, and our Star Trek bad guy celebrity grudge our, match edition of Metatrex?
Our pantheon of evil in Star Trek. Okay. So let's ask the same question about the Paw Wraiths that we asked about the Borg Queen and asked about Armus. Can we give a story about the Paw Wraiths, a backstory, a psychological analysis that makes them more sympathetic, that makes you go, aw, poor Paw Wraiths, in the same way that we could do with Armus, that we can't seem to do very well with the Borg Queen? I'm thinking of the episode Covenant in Deep Space Nine, when Gul Dukat is being possessed by a Paw Wraith. He's serving as the cult leader of the Paw Wraith cult on Empok Nor. Basically, Gul Dukat tries to say that the Paw Wraiths are just misunderstood. In the same way that Armus is misunderstood. And I guess the question is, does anyone buy that? Poor us, we're being oppressed by these oppressive, you know, beings that you call the prophets that rule over the wormhole with an iron fist.
Well, unfortunately, he's got a following of Bajorans who believe, at least to some degree. I think at the end of the episode, we find that only really one, and it was a former Vedic, was really a believer. Not even Gul Dukat believed his own, you know, his own baloney.
Well, that's a little more like the Borg Queen, right? I don't even believe my own rhetoric about perfection.
I think that's what makes Covenant such a great example, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because at the end of the episode, Gul Dukat doesn't even believe his own message. I mean, he's just completely deceiving and self-serving, and
it's almost like the Paw Wraiths are whiny children saying, "Oh, you know, those big bad prophets put me in my playpen, wouldn't let me out, and they're so mean." Say, "Oh, poor you," right? I guess is it plausible to say that the Paw Wraiths are just misunderstood, or are they oppressed, or is that just rhetoric and talk that's used to justify their evil actions, their quest for power, their quest for fill in the blank?
Yeah, and I think in the episode, I think it was all rhetoric. It was all talk. There was really nothing, you know, nothing substantial to it. Although outside of this episode, that rhetoric continued to spread, because, you know, we certainly see that these followers of the Paw Wraiths weren't contained to Empok Nor, but, you know, were rather scattered in little cells, if you will, you know, throughout Bajor.
Is there any other story we could give about the Paw Wraith? So we're not buying the poor oppressed Paw Wraith story.
Well, I think Jake answers an interesting question to some degree, one that I don't think that we're asking directly, but I think rather indirectly we're asking, and that is, when Jake is delivered, if you will, from the influence of Costa Mojin, he says to his father that he remembers the entity being inside of him, and the thing that he was struck by was the pure evil, the anger, the hatred of this creature that was inside of him. And so I think, Zachary, that may answer our question by and large. You know, certainly this Costimogen, at least, is a deeply malevolent being. Now, is there anything redeemable? I don't think we can answer that with what we've been given, other than, you know, Jake's recollection that, you know, this really was an evil. I almost get a picture in my mind of Armus.
I was just thinking that the Costimogen you just described sounds a lot more like Armus. Like Armus. He's got this raw kind of anger and raw hatred that is just dripping from him.
Yeah.
But that is what made Armus sympathetic, right? You can go, whoa, he feels abandoned, right? Oh, he's so angry. I guess, does that undermine the sense that the Paw Wraiths are truly evil? Like the Borg Queen, you can't go, oh, the Borg Queen is dripping with anger. She's too calculating. She's twirling her mustache too much, right? Costimogen is a little more like Armus. He's reactive in that sense, emotionally reactive.
But Costimogen and the Paw Wraiths were discharged from the Celestial Temple. I mean, even Kai Winn says that Costimogen is the evil one. She refers to him as being the evil one. So let's assume here that Costimogen is the leader of the Paw Wraiths. So Kai Winn describes Costimogen as the evil one, a Paw Wraith banished from the Celestial Temple. So I guess my question is this, you know, what in the world do you have to do to be banished from the Celestial Temple?
Something pretty bad,
I'm thinking.
Well, I want to continue this discussion about evil and the Paw Wraiths, but I want to do it in a slightly different way. Up till now, we've kind of been using this Judeo-Christian sense of evil. And as we were having that discussion, I started thinking about the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who held that the Judeo concept of evil was basically an invented concept, a way of inverting the power relationship between Jewish people who were traditionally the slave race and their masters. In the ancient world, according to Nietzsche, there was the quest for power. Some people were more powerful than others, and the people who had the power called themselves good. And the people who were dirty, the people who were slaves, the people who did all the work, all the unseen people that weren't part of the powerful nobility, for lack of a better word, were viewed as bad, undesirable, right? But according to Nietzsche, the Judeo-Christian worldview invented the concept of evil in the moral sense, not just in the sense of power. Mm-hmm. So by calling their masters evil and calling themselves good, they moralized and inverted the power relationship. And that story of inverting the power relationship by inventing the concept of morality or goodness versus evil, as opposed to good versus bad or powerful versus unpowerful, sounds very similar to what the Paw Wraiths are saying about the prophets. You know, in the Paw Wraiths worldview, they're just as powerful as the prophets, right? It's mm-hmm. a clash of titans, us versus them, right?
Yes.
And then they get banished, and the prophets in their lofty celestial temple call themselves the good ones and call the Paw Wraiths the evil ones, or in the case of Costimogen, the evil one. It's almost like they've invented this concept of goodness versus evil, propping themselves up as the good ones as a way of keeping the Paw Wraiths down, as a way of bolstering the power relationship that's been established when the Paw Wraiths were banished. It almost sounds very much like this Nietzschean concept of inventing the concept of morality.
So then it becomes an issue of virtues and defining terms as it pertains to virtues and ethics and, you know, what is right and what is wrong. And unfortunately, we live in a world where I think that's a sliding scale to some degree, because we have a tendency in our world to adjust the value of good or evil to behaviors or virtues or you know, whatever, plug it in there. We slide that scale based on, many variables in the times and seasons that we live in.
I guess the fundamental question for me in terms of an analysis of the concept of evil is whether the concept of evil or good versus evil is a primitive concept. Is that a fundamental part of the moral fabric of the universe, right? Is that something that is not reducible to something else? Or is that something that emerged historically? Or is it something that's derivative of something else? In the case of Nietzsche, it was derivative of power relationships. And I think that analysis actually applies pretty interestingly to the paw wraiths versus the prophets power struggle. I think people who are used to a Judeo-Christian worldview tend to think of good versus evil as a primitive concept that's built into their fabric of reality. Whereas if you try to give a sort of a deconstruction of the concept of good versus evil, like Nietzsche was trying to do, then you're going to be less interested in trying to figure out which beings are fundamentally good or which beings are fundamentally evil, because you're going to say this concept of good versus evil is not a fundamental necessary consequence of morality. It's something that was invented. It was something that was constructed. It didn't always exist. It came into being at some point for some other purpose. And, you know, in the case of Nietzsche, it was because of power relationships, a way of coming to grips with the fact that you're a slave in Nietzsche's view. And same thing with the prophets and the paw wraiths, right? The only way the prophets are justified in banishing the paw wraiths is to call them evil. And from the paw wraith standpoint, you could look at that and say, they're calling us evil, but all they're doing is propping themselves up in their celestial temple, like a king on high.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, when you give an analysis of good versus evil like that, does it undermine the concept of good versus evil as being central to morality? You know, can you give a deconstruction and an analysis of good versus evil in terms of something else? Or fundamentally, is good versus evil the primitive concept of morality?
And I think that's the fundamental question. The problem with that is that it's, at least for me, not terribly satisfying to look at it in those terms. And I realize that by and large has to do with my own biblical worldview, because I see and understand evil as being central to a being, and that being having opportunity sways people to do terrible things. I mean, I look around at the world that I live in, and I look at the attempt to wipe out the Jewish race, and I can say that's evil. I can look at terror attacks. I can look at these things, and I can say these things. And we all have our own. I mean, just depending on where you live, and you can look at things and fundamentally say, right there, that's proof that evil exists. And so to deconstruct evil in the way that you're suggesting, in the way that Nietzsche does it, it's just not satisfying to me.
You could run the example in a lot of different ways, right? You could say, let's take Armus, for example. Armus could justifiably say to Captain Picard, the only reason you're justified in sitting up in that comfy chair up on the bridge of the Enterprise D is to call me evil because I'm down here in this dirty planet. And if you're not calling me evil, you're not justified in sitting in your chair in your comfy luxury liner up there. I mean, even in Christian theology, right, Satan or Lucifer could plausibly say to God, the only reason you're justified in sitting up there on your throne and none of us are up there on that throne is that you call us evil and you call yourself good. Where do you get off? All it does is serve to bolster your own position of power. Why is that not a satisfactory explanation for Argus and Captain Picard? Why is it not a satisfactory explanation for Lucifer and God? Why is it not a satisfactory explanation for the paw wraiths and the prophets?
Or the Borg Queen, or...
I don't know if you can actually give the same kind of analysis about the Borg Queen, honestly, because the Borg Queen doesn't cry, oh, I'm the poor, oppressed Borg Queen. I don't think she ever does that, do you?
I don't think so. I think she does try to make a loose argument for being misunderstood.
Yeah, and I think that it's a loose argument because I don't think it's genuine, right? I think you see right through it and you go, oh, misunderstood because you're seeking perfection. Yeah, right.
but do we see through it because of our own preconceived ideas about her?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think she cries poor me too often.
No, I don't either. I referred to it as a loose argument.
And who would she cry poor me? I mean, it's not like she's oppressed. It's not like she's stuck on a dirty planet, you know, and covered in tar. Although she is viscous. it's not like she is banished to the fire caves. Right. So she's already in a position of power. So she doesn't have to give that poor me story. I think if she tried to give that poor me story, like the Paw Wraiths, or even like this hypothetical conversation between Armus and Captain Picard, or like Lucifer and God, it wouldn't be very plausible. I think it's actually much more plausible in all of the other stories than it is about the Borg Queen.
So you're saying the Borg Queen is still our reigning champion of all things malevolent?
Well, she seems to withstand our best attempt to deconstruct her evilness.
Truly. You mentioned earlier Khan. Khan! Khan! And I want to circle back to that, although I think it was loosely thrown out there, and I think that we can apply the same questions, the same kind of deconstruction to Khan that we did a Gul Dukat or a Kai Winn or a Tomalak or the Klingons, or plug in any number of other races that we've talked about, any other number of creatures that we've talked about on the podcast today. But Khan is an interesting character in that I think he was the closest thing the original series gave us to, you know, a truly anti-Kirk, anti-hero. And he really was, by and large, you know, Kirk's equal, as it were, in the struggle of good versus evil. But I think we can all agree that Khan wasn't necessarily evil. Khan was
not in,
Khan
not was in the driven. Original series.
I'm sorry?
Not in the original series, maybe in Star Trek II.
Yeah, Star Trek II. And I attribute Star Trek II to the original series. I'm not differentiating here, but
I think we need to, because I think in the original series, Khan is way more sympathetic than he is in
the Wrath without of Khan. A doubt.
Right. He is misunderstood. He does kind of have this poor me sob story, right? That is, you know, you kind of see through it, but it's also plausible, right? You kind of feel for the.
Yeah, I was gonna say, in. but does that sob story hold any water? Because he was in stasis for a reason. It was because he was power hungry, and I mean the eugenics war. But hello.
But he offered the world order, just like the Borg.
Now, it seems to me that you're trying to make a stronger case for Khan, but I think at the end of the day, yes, he was power hungry. Yes, he was certainly prideful, certainly driven in much the same way the Borg Queen was, but not in the scale and scope, I think, of the Borg Queen. And that there was at least a layer, I think, of something truly sympathetic there.
In the original series, young Khan, do you get the sense that he delights in the suffering of others?
I don't.
I don't either.
But,
and that's.
But I point back again to the eugenics wars. Let's not forget how he got where he is.
But under his rule, there were no wars, if you remember. So, honestly, I think young Khan, I think, is confident, overly confident, but has drunk his own Kool-Aid.
I was just getting ready to say, you're not drinking the Khan Kool-Aid, are you?
In the original series, I am, absolutely. But by the time the Wrath of Khan rolls around, he is on a quest for vengeance. Now, I guess my question about vengeance is, does the fact that his vengeance has an origin, right? His wife died and he resents Captain Kirk abandoning him on this, quote-unquote, abandoning him on this planet, right? Ironically, because it's not like he was abandoned on this desert wasteland. But he blames Captain Kirk, and it's been eating at him for 15 years. Does that make him more sympathetic or more evil, the fact that he is so reactive to this vengeance that he's willing to, you know, kill as many people as he can in the name of getting Captain Kirk? Or does the fact that he, you know, has this sob story that accounts for this vengeance, does that make him more sympathetic? I think you could kind of tell it either way.
No more so than I think Adolf Hitler was sympathetic. Because you can make an argument. You can go back and you can look at World War I history. You could look at the humiliation of Germany, the Treaty of Versailles, and what that meant for the German people and what that did to the German nation and how that gave rise to an Adolf Hitler type leader. And I think you can deconstruct Hitler psychologically and you can find reasons to sympathize. But at the end of the day, he made a clear choice to follow a path of unrestrained genocide that I think at the heart of that bloodlust was nothing but pure evil.
This is an interesting question about Khan. Does Khan have quote-unquote bloodlust in the way that you just characterized Hitler as having bloodlust? I don't know if that's true. He wants Captain Kirk. He's got a Captain Ahab complex. But I don't know if he has bloodlust per se. That doesn't sound like Khan to me.
I don't know. Maybe this is a question to ask Pavel Chekhov.
He wants Kirk. And he doesn't really care what other collateral damage there is. But it's not like he's got a systematic genocide in mind.
Yeah. I'll give you that. I don't, at least yet.
The Borg have systematic genocide in mind. They're going to assimilate entire worlds, right?
I was getting ready to make reference to the augments from Enterprise. Those brilliant episodes from the fourth season of Enterprise. I think that would be a very weak argument for the motives of someone like Khan. That would be no different than saying, well, all Klingons are bloodthirsty warriors, or all Romulans are, you know, sneaky backstabbing.
I guess with Khan, I can tell the same story I can about Armus. You, Captain Picard, up there in your luxury liner, he can say, Kirk, my old friend, up there in your comfortable chair, and I'm down here on this desert wasteland. You know, whatever. That was my best Ricardo Montalban. you call me evil while you're sitting up there.
The
you know,
ship, the with, ship.
With your... the ship.
I guess that makes me tattoo.
You're sitting up there, you know, with your phasers, you know, trained on me, having banished me to this desert wasteland with my dead wife barely cold. And where do you get off calling me, or I guess, where do you get off taking the moral high ground, Captain Kirk?
And I will not rest until you are buried alive.
I think Khan really believes some of this. So, you know, I think that makes him, in my mind, a little more sympathetic than the Borg Queen.
Maybe a little more. But I still don't put him in the same category.
As
a Borg Queen, or I just...
Oh, no, that's my point.
I think
it's
easy to deconstruct him to a great degree. I really do.
Thoroughly. I think Khan is easy to analyze, yeah. Easy to understand, easy to deconstruct in a way that the Borg Queen seems to resist this attempt to deconstruct her evil nature.
So, Zachary, it sounds like the Borg Queen sits high atop this pile of the good, the bad, and the ugly as not only the Queen of the Borg, but the Queen of Evil in Star Trek. Any final thoughts?
Maybe just a recap. I think we started the discussion by observing how difficult it is to find a truly evil character in Star Trek, and I think our discussion today bears that out. Star Trek tends to humanize and render its potentially evil characters, its villains and its bad guys, quote-unquote, more sympathetic. Tends to think of them as potentially redeemable, even if, in fact, at the end of the story, they're not redeemed if they get killed or whatnot in the course of the events. So we started out the discussion by having a pretty short list of potential evil candidates. You know, we talked about Armus, we talked about the Borg Queen, we brought Khan into the discussion. There aren't too many others. And the question then is, can you deconstruct these individuals? Can you give some satisfactory alternative explanation for their actions or their natures that is different than they're just pure evil? And with Armus, we found we could give a sob story. With Khan, we found we could give a sob story. But with the Borg Queen, we found we couldn't give much of a sob story. And even the Paw Wraiths, we were able to give a semi-convincing Nietzschean sob story. You know, you prophets up there in your celestial temple, you threw us down here into the fire caves, wham. You know, that...
it's weak, but...
It's weak, but you can tell it, and I think maybe the Paw Wraiths believe it, maybe they don't, we don't really know. But the Borg Queen seems to resist that attempt to give an alternative explanation for her evil nature. So, yeah, it was interesting that at the end of the day, the Borg Queen sits high atop the pantheon of evil characters in Star Trek, at least based on our discussion. Without a doubt, there are listeners out there who are going to think we forgot 10 or 15 or 20 other potential evil characters in Star Trek, which we didn't have time to discuss today. But please give us your thoughts on that inside the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook, and share your thoughts with us and see who we left out of the discussion, who the real evil characters in Star Trek are. But I think it says something about Star Trek that Star Trek doesn't just take bad things in the world or bad things in the universe or bad actions or bad motivations and go right to viewing those people or actions as evil. Star Trek tends to step back and say, well, let's try to understand them. Let's not be judgmental. Let's see if we can put ourselves in their shoes and understand their mindset. Let's see if we can change them. Let's see if we can have dialogue with them. Let's see if we can form a relationship with mm-hmm. them. And you know, Star Trek takes that constructive approach. By extension, maybe Star Trek thinks of the distinction between good versus evil as not terribly productive. When you distance yourself from someone and say, I'm good and you're evil, you are... almost ipso facto eliminating the potential for reconciliation, right? Sure. If one person is fundamentally evil and one person is fundamentally good, there's not a lot of middle ground you can find. And Star Trek tends to try to find the middle ground and try to find a constructive dialogue-based approach, and definitely in the Next Generation, to a lesser extent in the original series. Even in Deep Space Nine, by the end of the day, you know, enemies are working together. The Cardassians and the Bajorans are fighting side by mm-hmm. side, right? So Star Trek is largely skeptical of the concept of evil, I think. And yet there are interesting characters like Armus with the title Skin of Evil. And so you have to ask yourself, well, what is this? What is this role of evil in Star Trek? Because there are characters that claim to be evil or are viewed as evil by other characters in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, you know, can you always deconstruct that evilness into something else? Or is that evil fundamental or an essential part of those characters' natures? And I think out of all the examples we talked about, the Borg Queen seems to resist that deconstruction the best. And I think that's a really interesting conclusion at the end of the day.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I will say that, you know, we started out the discussion, we were talking about the nature of good and evil. And I don't know if we've really given a good argument for, you know, what is inherently good, what is evil. I think we had some interesting conversation around those concepts inside of our ipso facto kind of deconstruction of Star Trek characters to try to find, you know, a truly evil Star Trek character. And so I don't know that the conversation that we had today necessarily is going to answer any great questions that our listeners might have. It was a fun conversation, but I find it interesting, and I've always found it interesting, as you mentioned, that Star Trek has a tendency to paint their bad guys in a sympathetic light, to humanize them, if you will. And I think they did do that in the original series. I think that they were able to do that
certainly with the Romulans, because by and large, at least they were honorable to some degree.
Kodos the Executioner.
What's that?
Kodos the Executioner.
Even Kodos the Executioner. We talked about that just a couple of episodes ago. I think they've always done a really good job of humanizing these characters and exploring their characters in such a way to really cause you to step back and think about, you know, what really is. And I think that's interesting because we were in Cold War era during that time. And here's Star Trek saying, even your enemy has a story that's relatable.
Well, fundamentally, I think Star Trek has to take that approach because all of Star Trek's exploration of good versus evil and various ethical dilemmas and various political scenarios, all of those put the mirror right back at us. And so the second we start calling those individuals evil inside the Star Trek universe, we forget that that mirror is pointed right back at us, that those are aspects of all of us, whether internally, psychologically, or politically amongst different groups of people, that if we start moralizing inside Star Trek, we run the risk of forgetting that all of those observations about any of the characters and any of the alien races in Star Trek fundamentally point to each and every one of us inside of our moral sense and our sense of identity and our sense of who we are and what we struggle with and what our natures are.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Star Trek is trying to be optimistic about that. So by, you know, if Star Trek starts calling individuals and adversaries and alien races evil, we're essentially calling ourselves evil, and that's not a very good perspective on humanity. And Star Trek is trying to take a slightly more optimistic and productive path than that.
Yeah, by and large, I think Star Trek has done a wonderful job of, again, humanizing these characters and causing us to be circumspect about how we view them and to view them in a sympathetic light, to seek to understand them and their behaviors. And Star Trek has always, I think, shied away from this concept of what is truly evil. I think for the most part, it's tried to paint Starfleet and the Federation almost always as the good guy, but we don't always get that inside Star Trek. We certainly see examples of hypocrisy and corruption in the Federation and Star Trek. So we see, you know, presumably good people doing bad things. And we see good people doing questionable things in order to achieve a positive outcome. And we see examples of that in Star Trek. We see bad people certainly doing bad things, but we also see them many times do positive things for the benefit of greater good. And they do things that redeem them. I'm thinking of characters like Damar, for instance, who, you know, was, you know, certainly at one point in time, you know, an evil character inside Deep Space Nine. And by the end of that series, you know, Damar's a folk hero, for Pete's sake. So far removed from the Borg Queen.
And Kira, of all people, is fighting alongside him.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, what a picture there. And so I have that appreciation. So I think, with the exception of Armus of Vegra 2, that I think has a questionable argument. I think the Paw Wraiths, and I think there's lots of exploration that our listeners can do on the Paw Wraiths. Just to give you a list of Paw Wraith episodes, if you're interested in exploring the Paw Wraiths. You have, for instance, Image in the Sand. You have Shadows and Symbols. We mentioned Covenant, Till Death Do Us Part, Strange Bedfellows, Changing Face of Evil, When It Rains, and certainly The Reckoning that we talked about in great degree. So you can explore them. But Zachary, I'm with you. I think the Borg Queen sits high atop this villainous band of evil as queen.
I like the idea of doing a Paw Wraith rewatch.
I would encourage a Paw Wraith rewatch, Zachary. I think we should do, I think we should certainly do a, you know, occasionally you and I have done episodes in which we explore the virtue ethics of a species. I would be interested in doing a Borg virtue ethics episode.
Or the ethics of the Paw Wraith.
Hey, virtue Paw Wraith virtue ethics. I think we should do that.
Okay, we will add both of those to the list. I think our discussion today parallels the discussion about evil in philosophy, honestly. I think that we understand goodness, right? We have lots of examples, lots of familiar experience. I think even if you can't give a, you know, precisely defined account of it, we have an intuitive understanding of goodness. I think we have an intuitive understanding of badness. There are lots of bad things in the world, lots of suffering, lots of people being dishonest, lots of people doing any number of different things, right? So we understand badness, no problem. But there's a distinction between ordinary badness and evil, and it's that deeper sense of badness, that genuine evil concept that I don't think we have a as great of an intuitive understanding of. And all we seem to be able to do is to give a negative definition of it. You know, evil is not goodness. Evil is not jaywalking. Evil is not motivations. Evil is not fill in the blank. And we're left kind of spiraling towards this concept of evil that never gets precisely defined. One answer was Augustine's answer. Just say, well, it doesn't exist then. There is no thing to be defined because it's not a substantive force. But clearly inside Star Trek, we do have the Borg Queen, and we do have the Paw Wraiths, and we do have Armus, and we have good, at least potential candidates for evil. So it's not something you can just eliminate wholesale. And here in the real world, we have the Hitlers. So it's not like you can just ignore them and say they don't exist and they're not evil. You can try to psychoanalyze them, or you can try to mm-hmm. deconstruct them like Nietzsche did, but you're still left with the brute force suffering that they cause in the world, and it's hard to explain that away.
Indeed.
Especially when it's consciously done. And I think our discussion here just parallels that discussion. At the end of the day, we understand goodness. We have lots of examples of what evil is not, but we can't give this nice, tightly defined account of the definition of evil. And it's disappointing because you want to understand those things. You want to go, when you see that great degree of suffering in the world or in the Star Trek universe, you know, we see an entire world get assimilated. You want to understand what possible motivation could cause that amount of suffering and make it permissible in an evil person's eyes or in the Borg Queen's eyes. And fundamentally, good people will just never understand that. And I think that's the fundamental problem, that good people will just never understand evil, and our best attempt to understand it or summarize it or define it ends up dissatisfying at the end of the day.
And as Captain Picard teaches us, sometimes the best thing to do is to just warp away. Leave that stuff on Vega 2.
Well, Mike, it's been fun talking about Paw Wraith temper tantrums today, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere around the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
She is going to be one of the greatest comedic stars of this century. She is going to be amazing, and I love her. She's hilarious. But Tilly has become solely comedic relief in this episode. And Tilly is not just comedic relief. She is smart. Tilly is a smart person. She right. knows her job. She is going to be one of the greatest captains in Starfleet. I believe that.
Warp 5.
Wait, hold on. You don't have a reflection. There's beams of light traversing the ship, cutting you. Mm-hmm. And my lack of logic is what's astounding here.
Yeah, because you made an assumption based on zero evidence.
Except for the fact that they just melted.
Yeah, the three
we
that
don't
we've
know
seen,
for
we
a
don't
fact
know
that
what the rest of them are doing. This is
we
the first
we don't know
first
if
we've
it
seen.
Was anymore.
Okay, let's scan the melting.
Earl Grey.
But yes, I was a huge Star Trek fan. Never in my life ever imagined that I would ever appear or meet some of those fabulous people on that show. Never thought, and meet Gene Roddenberry. I never thought I would ever meet. Most of my life, I never thought would happen. So I feel very, very fortunate.
The 602 Club.
And it really speaks to me, Halliday's ego, even, of I'm going to make everyone love what I love, and then that's how they'll win the contest. You know, and it's sad that it feels like it all became that, what you're saying, Matt, of it, everyone not even having the creativity to have their own stuff anymore. It's all about what Halliday was interested in. And then I think, too, it really also could be even a commentary about greed in society now, that everything really revolved around wanting to get his, and you know, his fortune. So they did all the research they had to do because they just wanted the money.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we would love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to mind meld with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation with us is in the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select MetaTreks. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, speaking of contact information, Mike, when you're not getting your hands dirty in the slime pit down there with Armas, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, certainly on Facebook, that's where I am most active. I'd be happy to discuss Star Trek and philosophy in the Babel Conference with you. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm occasionally on Instagram. My handle over there is cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're actively trying to resist the Borg Queen's subtle voice, where can our listeners find you around the network and on the interwebs?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to all things Star Trek Voyager. You can also find me in the Babel Conference if you'd like to talk about Star Trek and philosophy with me in there. And you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network on Patreon. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. We'd also like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, and the individual who has the command codes for Pandora's Stasis Chamber, by the way. Our executive producers, Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and Brandon Shea Mutala, our Patreon manager. And a special thank you and a shout out to our four associate producers here on MetaTreks. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, you can find Kay at ChocoWeeble on Twitter. Norman Lau at Starfighter1701. And Mark Walker from Parts Unknown. Maybe from the Fire Caves on Bajor.
A benevolent crew all.
And Mike, we'd once again like to invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.